This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is the city's largest union of municipal employees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME, 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're on Sunday evenings at 8 p.m., and then we go on again. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. Assaults are the leading cause of injury among first responders nationwide. Last month, the state legislature took a step forward in addressing this by introducing a bill that better protects members of the uniformed services from assault when on the job. Joining us this evening to discuss this issue is uniformed EMTs and paramedics Local 2507 President Israel Miranda. President Miranda.
Hello to all our listeners out there.
Tell us about this bill. Tell us about the problem that precipitates the need for this bill.
Well, you know, as you had said, according to the Department of Labor, the leading cause of injuries to first responders, especially emergency medical service workers nationally, is due to assaults. Most people would think it would be accidents or other causes, but actually it's due to assaults. And even though we have tightened a lot of the legislative bills that deal with assaults for public employees, there are other types of assaults that we've never seen before. And this Community Heroes Protection Act, which they call the Heroes Bill, will hopefully address that statewide. On January 30th, I had the honor of being at a press conference in Albany to support this statewide legislative initiative. This law would increase penalties for those who commit crimes against any emergency service worker who is targeted solely because of their profession or the uniform they wear.
Now, just to be clear, as you just said, there are laws that currently exist that protect certainly uniform officers. I mean, it is a felony to attack a police officer, correct? I mean, there are penalties currently in place. This tightens that up. This makes this even stronger.
What it does, if the attack is because of their targeting you just because of the uniform you wear or your profession, obviously this bill will give courts the ability to stiffen the penalties that are designed. Right now, if you attack an EMS worker, it's a Class D felony, which is basically very close to a misdemeanor. If someone has a clean record or makes a deal with the courts, they probably get a low misdemeanor or a slap in the hand with community service. That doesn't really address the issue of why this person was assaulted, and you know, this person may have lost days' work or been really injured, and what it does to them psychologically. These are people that go out there to serve the community. They mean no harm. They only go there to help. And for them to be attacked while they're doing their profession, it's unacceptable.
And so so this new law or bill, which will hopefully become law, basically serves as a stronger deterrent to such behavior and assaults on EMTs and paramedics.
It does, but it basically focuses more on bias attacks.
Okay.
On more your profession and the uniform and the organization you represent. This bill will cover, is designed to protect all EMS personnel, firefighters, law enforcement, and correction personnel in New York State who are targeted solely because of their profession or the uniform they wear. You know, when you have a normal assault, you know, it's kind of a different situation. But when you're assaulted just because of what you do and the uniform you wear, That should be unacceptable because you're out there to serve the public.
Key sponsors of the bill are State Senators Martin Golden of Brooklyn, Fred Akshar of Binghamton, Patrick Galvan of the Buffalo area, and Democratic Assembly member Peter Abate of Brooklyn. It's Thursday morning as we're recording this. There is heavy snow falling down outside in New York City, and your folks are out there serving the public. Tell us what's happening in the middle of this snowstorm with EMTs and paramedics.
We expect the worst because transportation is very poor at this time due to the snow that has fallen, and we expect many accidents and other emergencies. We are running a contingency of 5 extra units in every borough. We have supervisors who have aides, EMTs and paramedics on it, and we have stepped it up with the resources we give because we know with the problems of getting around the city, you have no other choice to be able to bring down the response time by putting a lot more ambulances out there to be able to meet the needs of the community.
We're talking with Local 2507 President Israel Miranda. He is the head of the EMTs and paramedic local. Get back out there and keep me safe, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. And to all our listeners, God bless. And I'm honored to be on your show once again.
Always a pleasure, sir. You will be back soon.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union. I'm Chris Policano. This is the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. We're on Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. and then again on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. The legendary civil rights icon John Lewis, representative of Georgia, spoke at the local 371 Black History Celebration on Friday, February 3rd. We wanted you to hear what John Lewis had to say in the difficult times in which we now live. So here now, for the next 15 or so minutes, John Lewis.
Let me say to all of the members of the different unions, to all of the honorable elected officials,
down front,
to each and every one of you, I must tell you that I'm delighted, very happy, and very pleased to be here. You're a good-looking group. You're beautiful, handsome, you're fired up, and you're ready to go. Now, I didn't grow up in a big city like New York City.
Down front.
Or Buffalo or Syracuse.
Down front, down front.
Or Chicago or Atlanta. I grew up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery.
Yeah.
Outside of a little place called Troy. My father was a sharecropper, but in 1944, when I was 4 years old, how many of you remember when you were four? What happened to the rest of us? Well, in 1944, My father had saved $300, and a man sold him 110 acres of land. And on this farm, and we still own this land today, on this farm we raise a lot of cotton and corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chicken. Now tonight we have some chicken, some of us did, I know. Now, I know some of you like to eat chicken, right? But you don't know anything about raising chicken, right? Well, why don't we compare notes? But growing up there on that farm, it became my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens. If you listen for just one moment, let me tell you what I had to do as a young boy, about 8 or 9 years old. When the setting hen was set, I had to take the fresh eggs and mark them with a pencil, place them in the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you may be saying, now, John Lewis, why do you mark those fresh eggs with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest. And there would be some more eggs. And you had to be able to tell the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. Do you follow me?
Yes.
You don't follow me, don't you? You don't follow me. So when these little chicks were hatched, I would fool these setting hen. I would cheat on these setting hen. I would take these little chicks and give them to another hen. I'll put them in a box with a lantern, raise them on their own, get some more fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under their setting hen, and encourage the setting hen to stay in the nest for another 3 weeks. It was not the right thing to do. It was not the most loving thing to do. It was not the most nonviolent thing to do. But I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator and hatcher for Mrs. Roebuck. So, now, maybe not in New York City, but you probably don't know that much about this little book catalog. Any of you old enough to remember?
Yeah.
That big book?
Yeah.
That heavy book?
Yeah.
That thick book?
Yeah.
Some people call it the whoosh book. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. So I just kept on cheating on this setting here. It was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. But I just couldn't save enough money. So, but as a little child, about 8 or 9 years old, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and my cousins, I grew up with 6 brothers and 3 sisters. Many, many first cousins. But we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard, like you're gathered here. And my brothers and sisters and cousins were lying outside, but around the chicken yard, and I would start speaking and preaching. And when I look back on the Sunday chicken with their heads, Sunday chicken would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me today in the Congress. And some of those chickens were just a little more productive. At least they produce eggs. That's enough of that story. When we would visit the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Tuskegee, visit Birmingham, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white waiting, colored waiting, to go downtown on a Saturday afternoon to the theater to see a movie. All of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. Came home and I would ask my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But in 1955, 15 years old, in the 10th grade, I heard of Rosa Parks. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. The action of Rosa Parks, the words and leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble. I got in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. So inspired by what was happening in Montgomery, 50 miles away. And in 1956, at the age of 16, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we went down to the public library trying to get a library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for colors. I never went back to that building until July 5th, 1998 for book signing of my first book. Hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. We had a little reception, signed some books. End of the program, they gave me a library card. Aww. It says something about the distance we've come and the progress we've made in laying down the burden of race. Now, as a little child, 17 years old, I wanted to attend a college only about 10 miles from my home called Troy State College, now known as Troy University. I never heard a word from the school. I submitted my application, my high school transcript. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers. Told Dr. King I needed his help. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket and invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. In the meantime, I had been accepted at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill and a footlocker. I put everything that I owned in that footlocker, except those chickens, and took a Greyhound bus to Nashville. And after being in Nashville, Tennessee for about 3 weeks, I told one of my teachers that I'd been in contact with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This teacher informed Dr. King that I was there in Nashville. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in church and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So on a Saturday morning in March of 1958, 18 years old by now, I traveled from Troy to Montgomery. And an African-American lawyer by the name of Fred Gray, who was a lawyer for Rosa Parks, for Dr. King, and became our lawyer during the Freedom Rides and during the march from Selma to Montgomery, met me at the Greyhound bus station and drove me to the First Baptist Church, pastored by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague of Dr. King involved in a Montgomery bus boycott, and ushered me into the pastor's study. I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy standing behind the desk. I was so scared, I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King said, "Well, you're John Lewis. You're the boy from Troy." And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." He gave my whole name. He started calling me the boy from Troy. I went back and had a discussion with my mother and my father about what Dr. King said that we may have to sue Troy State, the state of Alabama. Not Troy University. A home could be bombed, or burned. We can lose the land. And I went back and had a discussion with my mother and my father. They were so afraid. So I continued to study in Nashville. And I met Rosa Parks, and I would see Dr. King from time to time, but he would come to speak. And with hundreds of students, we got involved in the city movement. By sitting down, by sitting in, we were standing up. So what you see happening today with the Women March, what you see happen at the airports, people are standing up. It is time for organized labor to stand up. To speak up, speak out, and get in the way, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. And let me just say that, you know, no one want to go to jail. No one want to be beaten. But I was arrested in jail 40 times during the 60s. The first time I got arrested was during the sit-ins. There were black and white college students and some high school students. Students and young people from all across America, from New York City, that came south to study. We studied the way of peace. We studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied the way of love. We'd be sitting down
on a stool at a lunch counter, or sitting in at a restaurant, and someone would come up and spit on us, put a lighted cigarette out in our hair, or down our backs, pour hot water, hot coffee, or hot chocolate on us. And then we were told, you know, if you continue to sit in, you're going to be arrested. Never been arrested before. Never seen the inside of a jail. But I thought about it and said to myself, if I go to jail, if I get arrested and go to jail, I wanted to look what some young people would call fresh. I wanted to look clean. I wanted to look sharp. So a few days before the next sit-in, I went to a used men's store and bought a used suit. A vest came with it. I paid $5 for this suit. And if you have an opportunity to come to Washington and visit my congressional office, have a very large photograph of me being arrested with 87 other young men and women. I look sharp. I did look clean. So sometimes we must learn to disturb the order of things. Sometimes we have to speak with our feet. Sometimes we have to speak with our hands. But whatever you do, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said over and over again, keep moving. That's what we did on the march from Selma to Montgomery. We spoke up. We spoke out, and we got in the way. We got in trouble. We were beaten. We were left bloody. I almost died on that bridge. Had a concussion. But just think, a few short years ago, in the heart of the American South, people could not register to vote simply because of the color of their skin. People were asked to count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap, the number of jelly beans in a jar. And some people said today, it is hard, it is difficult. But anything worth having, it is going to be hard. Here in this city, just remember, you must remember that three young men, two from New York City and one from Mississippi that I knew, Michael Sherrin and James Chaney and Andrew Goodman, gave their lives. They died not in the Middle East, not in Africa or Central or South America. But these three young men went out to investigate the burning of an African-American church used for voter registration workshop. Detained by the sheriff. Turned over to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, murdered, and buried on a mound of dirt. And some of us are going to say today, it is hard. Look, we got to hang in there. We got to hang in there. There are forces in Washington today and across America that want to take us back. But we're not going back. We come too far. We're not going back. We're going forward.
Forward ever.
Since I've been in Congress, I've been arrested another 5 times. My last arrest was trying to get the former Speaker of the House to bring forth comprehensive immigration reform bill.
Yes.
If the Speaker had brought this bill forth, almost every single Democrat would have voted for it, and we would have got enough Republican, and President Barack Obama would have signed it into law.
That's
right.
That's right.
So we can't stop now. We cannot say we are tired, that we are weary.
That's right.
Look, when you see something that is not right, not fair, not just. You have a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to stand up, say something. You cannot be silent. You cannot afford it. So I want to congratulate this union and all members of union. I want to congratulate organized labor, period. I want to congratulate the women that participated in the Women's March. And a thousand and thousand turnout here in New York. More than 500,000 in Washington, D.C. And even in a small city like Atlanta, we had more than 63,000 people. And last Sunday evening at the airport, we had more than 5,000 people there. I marched with them. I walked with them. So I said to you tonight, don't get weary. Don't get lost in a sea of despair. Keep the faith. Keep your eyes on the prize. Keep pushing. Keep pulling.
That was John Lewis, representative of Georgia. Legendary civil rights icon talking at the local 371 Black History Celebration on Friday, February 3rd, talking about where we are at a difficult time in our everyday lives. And in just the first, you know, in just the first few weeks of the Trump administration, there has been introduced national right to work legislation in the House of Representatives. Donald Trump has nominated Neil Gorsuch for the U.S. Supreme Court. Betsy DeVos has been confirmed as Education Secretary. Andrew Pudster has been named the Labor Secretary. There is a long list of folks who are not, to put it mildly, don't have the interests of working men and women at the top of their priority list. Gorsuch is an anti-worker judge. There is now before the courts, the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land. They will be deciding next in the next session of the Supreme Court about the fate of public employee unions and the ability to both collectively bargain and to organize. And DC 37, we are carrying out our own 100 days of resistance fight back. We will not be backing down during this age of Trump. And we're starting by urging folks to call their senators and tell them that we do not want Neil Gorsuch as the Supreme Court judge. Tell Senators Gillibrand and Schumer to reject Judge Gorsuch. You can call 202-224-3121. You can also check out the DC 37 website, where we make it easy for you to send a letter to your senator in case you live in New Jersey or Connecticut or anywhere in the metropolitan area. Go to the DC 37 website, www.dc37.net, and find out how you can contact your senator. You know, this nomination comes after Republicans first refused to consider former President Barack Obama's choice for the Supreme Court's vacant seat, which opened up in 2016 with the death of Antonin Scalia. And the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association case had threatened to allow non-union members to withhold their dues, reversing a practice upheld by courts over four decades. The death of Scalia was a coincidence that enabled us to keep our collective bargaining rights and our organizing rights. Those rights are still threatened with more cases coming before the Supreme Court in the next year, 2 years. And we need very much to let people know that we support the bargaining rights of workers and the organizing rights of workers. That's just about all the time we've got on the show for this week. If you've listened to anything here and want to comment on it, State of the Union at dc37.net. Drop us a line, and if we have the time, we will read some of your comments on the air. Andrea Monocchio is the engineer. Rudy Orozco is the producer. I'm Chris Policano. This is State of the Union. Until next time, ciao.